I'm in my late 60s, the letter begins. A former journalist turned college professor, I stand closer to the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder than the top, where I probably belong. I cannot stop brooding about my parents. Although he was a good provider, my father was psychologically abusive. When I earned a 93 on a difficult chemistry test at a difficult school, he replied, "What happened to the other 7 points?" And that was probably the nicest thing he ever said to me. I was not only a good student, but also a good ball player. Yet my father kept telling me I would never amount to much. My mother did nothing to counter his talk, and both of them were physiologically abusive with incessant smoking. The letter to the counselor ends with one question. How can I stop the brooding? It's easy to look back at the Israelites and shake our heads at their faithlessness. But these people were in a wilderness. They were without a home, but still responsible for their families. There's no functioning macroeconomy out here and no secure sense of their future. They were living as transients and had been following a guy who, may have led their escape from Egypt. But when having enough food for you and your family is now a day-to-day proposition, wherein you have to trust that every single person in your nation is going to have the guts and the moral courage and the superhuman restraint to resist the urge to turn this into a competition and take for themselves the limited amount of food available to all the people, manna. The only leadership question that matters is, what have you done for me lately? What has to happen? What does it take in order to cause people to look for a new idol, a new God, a new leader in whom to invest their ultimate trust? Seth Godin has written about two related phenomena. He calls them FOMO and KIMO, F-O-M-O and K-I-M-O. FOMO, he says, is the fear of missing out. It can completely undermine a life well lived, he says, because it drives people to follow a crowd out of fear. KIMO, on the other hand, is in the past tense, knowing I missed out. Over and over, the people remember, first romanticizing and then mythologizing practically, their memories that back in Egypt, where they were enslaved and oppressed and treated with harsh cruelty for the crime of having been born into the people that they are, they still had enough to eat. Every time they accuse Moses of having brought them out of Egypt just to kill them in the desert with hunger and thirst, there's a past tense at work. You brought us out here. They left, past tense, they left the place where there was food on the table. And every time their stomachs growl or they look at their 1538th bowl of plain manna, it's KIMO. K-I-M-O. I know I missed out on staying behind in Egypt where this bowl of manna wouldn't even qualify as food. But then something else happens. Moses has been gone for a while up on the mountain being instructed by God face to face. There's no cell phone coverage out there. Nobody knows what's happened to Moses or even whether or not he's still alive. He is the Lewis and Clark expedition, gone off to some place where there is literally no way to know his status. He's Michael Collins, doing a low orbit around the far side of the moon, becoming for an extended moment the most isolated living human being since the creation of the world. And they fear he is Amelia Earhart, having flown off out of radio range into the unknown. But their most immediate fear is not for Moses. It's for themselves as individuals and themselves as a people. He went to talk with God. Everybody knows no mortal does that and lives. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said to him, "Come, make gods for us who shall go before us. As for Moses, the one who brought us out of Egypt, we have no idea what may have become of him." What has to happen? What does it take in order to cause people to look for a new God in whom to invest their ultimate trust? Maybe an answer to that lies in the answer to a more immediate question. How can I stop the brooding? I'm hungry. I'm worried about my family and my security. I ran out of patience so long ago I can't even remember ever having had it to lose. I can't stop thinking about, can't stop brooding about the slights and the cruelties I have absorbed at the hands of people who were supposed to help me grow into this world. I can't stop brooding about the bad decisions, the failures on my part and on other people's part. I can't stop brooding on the fear-based and dim-witted hatreds that people are spouting from every available medium and the moronic way those flames are being fanned by people who could and should be tamping them down. And I keep compounding all my accumulated feelings of knowing I missed out with the fear of missing out on even more. So first I invest my treasure in some fantasy that I hope can protect and lead me, though there is no evidence of it, turning over not just my gold, but my family's too. And then I invest myself in following it and worshiping it when I already have a God who has already rescued and delivered me. When J.B. Phillips wrote "Your God is Too Small" back in the 1950s, he described a number of different ways that people imagine who or what God is, all of which will, guaranteed, ultimately, eventually prove inadequate. Resident policeman, parental hangover, managing director, perennial grievance, projected image, God in a box. But I need a God who is bigger. I need a God who is bigger than this moment, because I do not feel bigger than this moment. I need the God who went to the cross to give up everything, and in doing so, redeemed the whole universe. I need the God who, in the words of Terry Eagleton, is not some mega manufacturer, but is what sustains all things in being by divine love, and would still be this even if the world had no beginning, who is the reason why there is something rather than nothing, who is not a celestial engineer at work on a superbly rational design that will impress his research grant team, but an artist who made the world with no functional end in view, but simply for the love and delight of it, who made it as a gift, superfluity, and gratuitous gesture out of nothing rather than out of some grim necessity. I need the living God who is big enough that I can go about living my small life and doing my small acts of kindness and generosity. The God who is vast enough to bind together all of our small acts, quiet acts, neighborhood acts of goodness and giving and forgiving and welcoming and speaking up for people and standing by people and refusing to retreat into silence when the voices of hatred and division and intimidation and fear are pounding at the door. The living and loving God, who, unlike any lifeless, spiritless God, decides to stand and wait with open arms for my return, even when I had lost my nerve and tried to turn to invented gods. Your people, God said to Moses, have acted perversely. They've been quick to turn aside from the way that I commanded them. Oswald Chambers, the Scottish minister whose devotional book, My Utmost for His Highest, was published a few years after his death in Cairo in 1917, said, "We are not made for the mountains, for sunrises, for the other beautiful attractions in life. These are simply intended to be moments of inspiration." He said, "We're made for the valley and the ordinary things of life. That is where we have to prove our stamina and strength." And I would submit that it is also where we have to learn and face the fact that our own stamina and strength can never be entirely adequate. They can be great, they can be epic, they can be inspirational. We seem to set the bar really low for ourselves and doubt the strength of people who are made in the image of God, which we all are, every human being is. But our strength and stamina are also finite. We are made in the image of God, but we are not God. Only God is big enough to be God. And God is big enough, bigger than my life and yours and all life, bigger than eternity, bigger than this moment. Sarah Bessie recently wrote, "Set out, pilgrim, set out into the freedom and the wandering. Find your people. God is much bigger, wilder, more generous, and more wonderful than you imagined." Which I suppose is similar to the words of Madeleine L'Engle when she said, "Faith is what makes life bearable. With all its tragedies and ambiguities and sudden, startling joys, we don't need a new God. We haven't even begun to comprehend the real God. But we know God. And God has already shown us what it means to be fully alive, fully human, in the person of Jesus, who on the last night of his earthly life reminded his followers, "You know the way to where I'm going. We know how to do this." A lot of people are frazzled right now and feel like we're at the end of our rope. But God is infinitely bigger than this moment. And we have not forgotten the way that God commanded. "Beloved," wrote Paul to the church at Philippi, "whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is pleasing, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, and if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. Keep on doing the things that you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, and the God of peace will be with you."